Hello and welcome to Roots of Today, the podcast where the past meets the present. With every episode, we journey through time, uncovering the lessons, parallels, and connections between historical milestones and current events to create a deeper understanding of the compelling stories and issues that shape the news. This week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, has once again stepped into the headlines. Dr. Demetri Daskalakis, a top CDC leader, resigned in a blistering letter accusing the agency's leadership of bowing to politics, distorting science, and endangering vulnerable communities. His words hit hard. This came only weeks after Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. dismissed the entire Vaccine Advisory Committee, citing conflicts of interest. It's a decision that shocked public health circles and reminded us how fraught the relationship between science, politics, and the public has always been. All of this raises questions about whether Americans can still trust the nation's flagship public health institution. It's not like that trust has been on solid ground over the last 5 years, as it is. The COVID pandemic brought with it a whirlwind of conflicting reports and conspiracy theories regarding the disease. Early on, some doctors came forward with claims that they had treated patients with a combination of easily available drugs, yet those doctors were seemingly silenced, with accusations that their careers were destroyed. Furthermore, the pushback from the CDC on these treatments became increasingly political in nature. While Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Deborah Birx became household names and consistently supported draconian measures like shutting down businesses and schools until the promised COVID vaccine was ready for mass rollout, some state governors were making it impossible for doctors to treat patients on their own, citing CDC advisory directives and taking the unheard-of action of threatening to revoke the medical license of any doctor that failed to toe the government line. As always, this is Alan, your host, reminding you to grab your coffee, tea, or whatever beverage you prefer, and prepare yourself, because we are going to peel back the curtain and take a hard look at the CDC to answer some very basic questions. Where did the CDC come from? Why has it stumbled at key moments? And what about the often criticized ties between public health leaders and the pharmaceutical industry? To answer those questions, we need to start in an unlikely place, the swamps of the American South. In 1942, as American troops trained for World War II, malaria was a hidden enemy. Soldiers in southern training camps weren't falling to bullets, but to mosquitoes. The disease had long plagued the South, and wartime mobilization only made it worse. To fight it, the government created the Malaria Control in War Areas Program, MCWA. Its mission was straightforward: drain swamps, spray DDT, and keep soldiers healthy enough to fight overseas. When the war ended, one man, Dr. Joseph Mountain, argued this work shouldn't stop. If we could protect soldiers from disease, why not protect civilians too? His vision became reality on July 1, 1946, when the Communicable Disease Center opened its doors. Why Atlanta? Partly because it was near the malaria problem, but also because Emory University and local civic leaders wanted it there. In 1947, Emory sold the agency 15 acres of land for just $10, a symbolic gesture that secured the CDC's permanent home. That's how Atlanta became the unlikely capital of American public health. From its early days fighting malaria, the CDC grew quickly. It added divisions for polio, smallpox, and influenza. By the 1950s and 60s, it was already shaping national responses to new outbreaks. But with growth came scrutiny. Take the 1976 swine flu scare. A young soldier at Fort Dix in New Jersey died of a flu strain that looked alarmingly similar to the virus behind the 1918 pandemic. Fearing a repeat catastrophe, the CDC pushed for a nationwide vaccination campaign. Nearly 45 million Americans rolled up their sleeves. But the pandemic never came. Instead, the vaccine was linked to Guillain-Barré syndrome, a rare but serious side effect. About one in every 100,000 vaccinated developed the condition. Public trust plummeted, and the campaign became a textbook case of how acting fast can sometimes backfire. Then there's the Tuskegee syphilis study. When we speak about the darker chapters of American medical history, The Tuskegee Syphilis Study stands as one of the most infamous examples of systemic abuse and neglect of African-American citizens by their own government. The study began in 1932 in Macon County, Alabama. Sponsored by the U.S. Public Health Service in cooperation with the Tuskegee Institute, its stated purpose was to observe the natural progression of untreated syphilis in African-American men. But behind the language of observation lay a deception that would last 40 years. Researchers recruited 600 African-American men, 399 who had latent syphilis, and 201 who did not. The men were overwhelmingly poor, many sharecroppers, and most had little access to health care. They were told they were being treated for bad blood, a local term that could mean anything from anemia to fatigue. In exchange for their participation, the men received meals, transportation to the clinic, and free burial insurance. What they did not receive was the truth about their illness or meaningful treatment. Even in the early 1930s, effective treatments for syphilis, such as arsenical compounds, existed, though they were difficult to administer and had side effects. But in the 1940s, when penicillin became widely recognized as a safe and effective cure, the men in Tuskegee were deliberately denied the drug. In fact, public health service doctors actively prevented participants from accessing penicillin programs, ensuring that the study could continue. The goal was never to heal, but to watch syphilis ravage the body. The men suffered blindness, mental deterioration, heart disease, and death. Many infected their wives, and children were born with congenital syphilis. Yet year after year, the researchers wrote reports and tracked their subjects, treating them as medical specimens rather than human beings. The study only came to light in 1972 when whistleblowers and journalists exposed the truth. The public outcry was immediate. The government shut the program down, and lawsuits followed. In 1974, a $10 million settlement was reached, and medical benefits were promised to surviving participants and their families. But no settlement could erase the decades of suffering. The long-term consequences of Tuskegee extend far beyond those men and their families. The study fueled widespread mistrust of the medical establishment among African Americans. To this day, public health researchers acknowledge that the legacy of Tuskegee makes it harder to build trust in medical research, vaccinations, and clinical trials. In 1997, President Bill Clinton issued a formal apology on behalf of the United States. Speaking directly to the few surviving participants and their families, he admitted, "What was done cannot be undone, but we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away." That moment of recognition was important, but it also underscored how long it had taken for America to face the cruelty inflicted in the name of science. For many, Tuskegee represents not just a failure of medicine, but a breach of citizenship and civil rights. The men were denied truth, autonomy, and basic dignity. Their story forces us to ask uncomfortable questions about race, power, and the ethics of government authority. Questions that remain deeply relevant today. Fast forward to the early 2000s. In Washington, D.C., dangerously high levels of lead in drinking water triggered a health crisis. The CDC's communications on the matter relied on incomplete data and downplayed the risks to children. Years later, Congress and the Government Accountability Office concluded the agency had given the public a misleadingly reassuring message. In 2014, the danger wasn't outside, it was inside CDC labs. Live anthrax samples were mishandled. A deadly flu virus was contaminated and accidentally shipped to another lab. The incidents led to scathing congressional hearings and a shakeup in lab safety protocols. And of course, in 2020, the world saw how even a small failure could have global consequences. As COVID-19 spread, the CDC rushed to develop a test, but the first kit sent out to state labs simply didn't work. Internal audits later found basic quality control lapses. In those crucial early weeks, America lost time it couldn't afford. But perhaps the most enduring controversies don't involve lab mistakes or missed warnings. They involve money, influence, and perception. First, the CDC Foundation. Created by Congress in the 1990s, it's an independent nonprofit designed to support CDC projects. The foundation can, and does, accept money from corporations, including pharmaceutical companies like Merck, AstraZeneca, and Amgen. Officially, these donations are earmarked for specific projects, and come with transparency requirements. But critics argue that when Big Pharma funds the nation's top public health agency, it raises unavoidable questions about influence. Then there are royalties. Under federal law, when CDC scientists help develop a vaccine or diagnostic tool, they're entitled to a share of the royalties if those inventions are licensed to industry. The payments are capped and reported, but the optics can be troubling. Imagine a scientist advising on vaccine policy while also receiving checks tied to vaccine sales. Even if safeguards are in place, the perception alone can erode trust. In the case of the COVID vaccine, the optics were disastrous. First, Americans were told the vaccine was completely safe, while at the same time the drug companies lobbied for all of their research data to be sealed from the public for 75 years. When the vaccine was forced upon the public, people were told that getting the shot meant you couldn't get COVID, nor pass it on to anyone else. When that was shown to be false, the government demanded people get a third booster. When the immunity from the booster never materialized, the CDC moved the goalposts and claimed that while it couldn't stop the spread of the infection, it did lighten the severity of the disease. Even today, the CDC is still advising people to get the COVID vaccine, as evidence piles up that the explosion in myocarditis cases may be linked to the vaccine. The mainstream press utterly failed to fulfill its role and actually investigate and report on the entire affair. Legitimate questions were never asked, such as, how much money did the CDC and decision-level bureaucrats make from the pharmaceutical companies? Why was the research buried by the CDC, never to see the light of day for 75 years? The fact that these questions still remain unanswered fuels conspiracy theories and damages the reputation of the CDC. And then, there's the revolving door. Perhaps the most famous case came in 2010 when Dr. Julie Gerberding, a former CDC director, left the agency to head up Merck's vaccine division. Later, she became one of Merck's top executives. To critics, this looked like confirmation that CDC leaders could cash in with industry jobs. To defenders, it was simply a qualified expert moving into the private sector. Nevertheless, the incestuous relationship between the CDC and Big Pharma raises one important question. How can the CDC be expected to do its part to protect the health of the public when it is also part of the profit motive of the drug companies? These ties are not unique to the CDC. The FDA and NIH face similar scrutiny. But because the CDC's work touches nearly every American, from childhood vaccines to food safety, the stakes feel higher, which brings us back to today. Dr. Daskalakis's resignation and Secretary Kennedy's decision to fire the Vaccine Advisory Committee aren't happening in a vacuum. They tap into decades of suspicion that politics bends science, that money bends policy, and that the CDC can't always be trusted to speak plainly. To be fair, there have been reforms. Conflict of interest disclosures for advisory committee members are now required at every meeting, and recusals are common. A recent study even found that financial conflicts of interest among vaccine advisors have dropped dramatically over the past 20 years. But perception is powerful, and perception is what drives trust. The irony is that the CDC was founded to fight an enemy that couldn't care less about politics, the mosquito. Yet nearly 80 years later, its biggest battles are not only against viruses and bacteria, but against skepticism, partisanship, and the ever-present shadow of industry money. The CDC began with a $10 land deal and a mission to control malaria. It went on to help eliminate smallpox and fight polio. But it also stumbled through Tuskegee, swine flu, lab mishaps, and COVID testing. At its best, the CDC is a scientific bulwark against disease. At its worst, it becomes an institution caught between science, politics, and profit. The question for us is whether the CDC can navigate these pressures and keep public trust, or whether the forces of politics and perception will continue to erode its authority. RFK Jr. appears to be on a mission to erect a firewall between regulatory responsibilities and the corporate profit motive. Time will tell if his efforts are beneficial or if they damage the organization. But maybe, just maybe, staffing the CDC with folks wary of the motives of the drug companies isn't a bad thing. That concludes this week's episode. If you find this podcast informative or entertaining, please like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. The same goes if you tune in on YouTube. Also, if you have anything you would like to add to the conversation, or if there is a topic you would like to see covered on this show, please leave a comment. Until next time, remember this: get informed and fight to keep your political representatives accountable. Your freedom depends on it.